All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network, watching the stupid idiot president give a statement at the White House right now. Should we listen to it? Let's listen
Wait
to it.
Paris.
I'm sorry. I can't not listen to it.
There's also a growing recognition among European nations.
See, it's a bunch of crap, though. He's just reading a statement. He's not talking about breaking news. Anyway, here's the breaking news. The Turks shot down a Russian jet, apparently over Syrian territory, not Turkish territory, today. They claimed, oh, we warned them 10 times in 5 minutes and they wouldn't leave. But yeah, that doesn't really sound very likely to me. And the plane went down. Putin says 6. Earlier reports I heard said 4 miles inside Syrian territory. Although it's a very squiggly border, so... But old Vladimir Putin's point is well taken, that regardless, he said, if they had strayed over the line or not, they clearly did not mean any harm to Turkey. They clearly were not attacking Turkey. Reports said they were attacking Chechens, what they call Russians, Russian fighters on the ground. In Syria were their targets, not in Turkey. And Putin was pissed. He said, and then they go and call a meeting of NATO as though we were the ones who shot their plane down. Weren't they the ones who shot our plane down, he said. So, anyway, I don't know exactly what's behind it or what's the Turks' problem here or, you know, whether the Americans and them agreed to do this or whether the Americans are now trying to rein them in. Or what? I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. Let's see if this idiot is done doing anything but read his stupid statement here about how much he loves France yet.
Here, I want you to know that we will continue to do everything in our power to defend our nation. Since 9/11, we've...
Yeah, it's still his stupid statement. He's still not talking about the damn breaking news. Which, you know what, is probably for the best. The last thing we need is for him to take a position, which would certainly be wrong. Am I right? Anyway, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. The I Hate Government a Whole Lot show. And Eric Margolis will be on again. Because yesterday he was on teaching us a history lesson about the French in the Middle East. But today, he's going to be on to talk about what's going on in Syria now. And, so yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see. Oh, you know what, Blassett? I never did get a chance, or I probably did, but forgot to. Read Hillary Clinton's entire speech to the Council on Foreign Relations. That she gave the other day. Did you guys see that? The one thing for sure that I took note of was in Scott McConnell's article, Hillary Has Learned Nothing from the Iraq War, that he wrote for the American Conservative magazine. And McConnell has come out pretty strongly for war against the Islamic State at this point. But he points out in Hillary's speech how when she starts to talk about ISIS, she immediately changes the subject to Iran and Syria and Hezbollah. They're the ones who must be limited. They're the ones who must be stopped. They're the ones whose influence must be rolled back and curtailed when, of course, they're the enemies of the Islamic State. They're the greatest enemies of the Islamic State. And so, she just goes to reveal right there that she still, after all this time, she can't change her policy. The Israeli way, the Likud party's doctrine is her command. Simple as that. And you tell me, and I know, I'm sorry I say the same thing every day on here. Believe me, I'm getting sick of saying the same damn thing too. But it's still true, and nobody will make it stop being true. How could any politician in the world justify taking the side of Al-Qaeda? But they do it. I saw Noah Rothman today, the Israel lobbyist, complaining that, look, Russia is not bombing ISIS. They're bombing others. Others? You mean Al-Qaeda. You're crying they're bombing Al-Qaeda. And why? Because Hezbollah is an enemy of Israel. Not of America. Hezbollah never did anything to America. It was even the Amal militia that blew up the barracks in 1983, which would have been irrelevant anyway. And Hezbollah is not even an offensive threat to Israel. The only sense that they're a threat is that they have the ability to defend themselves. They have the ability to push Israeli armor back out of Lebanon when it tries to enter. That's Israel's problem. But for Democratic, Republican, doesn't matter, politicians in Washington, D.C., more than a year and a half after the declaration of the caliphate, even still after the attack in Paris, oh, we gotta beat ISIS. Oh, we gotta beat ISIS. Did I ever tell you how much we gotta destroy all of ISIS's enemies first? And now she sorta took that back and, you know, it's not like she means what she says. Either way, it's kinda hard to tell, but in the follow-up questioning, Fareed Zakariyyeh sounded like me. Someone on Twitter pointed that out. Fareed Zakariyyeh said, so wait a minute now. The policy is to build up a group of rebels that, as of right now, basically don't exist, and build them up in order to be so powerful that they can take on the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda on one side, and the Assad government and their allies, the Iranians, Hezbollah, and Russia, and then establish a secular democracy in Damascus. Is that what you're saying is supposed to happen here, Madam Secretary? And he says it with all due respect, which is hilarious, because I don't know how he said that without just the worst contempt. Well, you just heard the way I said it. I can't help but even, you know, I can't paraphrase him in his tone of voice. And she laughs and goes, well, when you phrase it like that, well, but that's how she's phrased it. That's the policy. That's what she claims. That's what Hillary Clinton claims. We're going to build up the moderates, and they're going to completely destroy all the jihadists and the secular Baathist regime and its army and all its allies and replace it all with a secular Western European nation state. A democracy. And if that's not what she's still selling, then what's the policy now? She says, oh, in her answer, she goes, well, no, you know, we got to prioritize. Gee, I would have never put it like you just put it, Fareed Zakariyyeh, even though that's a perfect paraphrase of what the Democrats have been selling us for 4.5 years. Oh, and the Republicans have been selling us for 4.5 years straight in Syria. Support the moderates. Support the moderates. Here's some TOW missiles for the moderates. Here's $1 zillion for you moderates as they chop off people's heads and set off suicide bombs and kill civilians for refusing to convert. They're all so very moderate. But then, I don't know, I just kind of like that part. The way she laughs is like, no, that sounds absurd when you put it that way. But, you know, and then tries to weasel out of it like that's not what she ever said. But anyway, and, you know, I wonder whether it's so much about Israel or whether it's more about the Gulf states and the money that they put directly into her family's bank accounts through the Clinton Foundation. I mean, talk about the purloined letter. I mean, this is Halliburton-level financial conflicts of interest at play when it comes to the Clintons and the way they make their money. Lots and lots of money.
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, Al Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. This guy, Trump, it is highly, 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 highly unlikely I will use nukes. I won't be nuking anybody, Trump assured GQ magazine. Under any circumstances, I'll have a military that's so strong and powerful and so respected, we're not going to have to nuke anybody. It is highly, 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 highly unlikely that I would ever be using them. You know, yeah, somehow that doesn't make me feel much better. You know, on the other hand, I could change my mind at a moment's notice, for reasons no one else could discern or could possibly agree would be good enough. But, you know, daisy cutters, nukes, what's really the big difference? Flash, no flash?
Man. Alright, well, anyway.
Oh man, oh man, I should have X'd out so many of these tabs before the show started today. There are so many that I don't need here. Well, I like this. This will help get us all on the same page together. It's Seamus Milne in The Guardian. Now the truth emerges. How the U.S. fueled the rise of ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Well, he's been writing the truth about this all along. It's not like it's been recently revealed to him or anybody else. It's just another little clue. But I like it. The War on Terror, that campaign without end, launched 14 years ago by George Bush, is tying itself up in ever more grotesque contortions. On Monday, and this is a few days old here, this is from, oh, this is freaking old. How did I not know that this was from June? Jeez, we didn't run this, did we? I think we might have run this like it was new. Wait a minute, is this still in there? It's from June. I still like it anyway. Hang on, I'm going to read to you the part I like here in just a second. I think we already ran it the other day, and nobody even called us out for running an article that was old. Anyway, check it out. Here's the part that you'll like. It's timeless. At least for 2015. The prosecution abandoned the case, apparently to avoid embarrassing the intelligence services. The defense argued going ahead with the trial would have been an affront to justice when there was plenty of evidence the British state itself was providing extensive support to the armed Syrian opposition. His lawyers showed in court that MI6 was backing the same, quote, rebel groups of jihadist terrorists that he was accused of supporting. So they dropped the charges. Ha ha. Remember there was one like that here, probably 2013, right? Remember that? Where the dad was complaining. The FBI and the Justice Department were prosecuting this kid for going to Syria to provide material support to terrorist groups. And the dad said, but he was recruited by the CIA to go. He's joining the rebels to fight against Assad. Isn't that American foreign policy right now? I'm confused. And then I think he just pled guilty and got 20 years instead of the death penalty or life in prison or whatever it was. Never got a fair trial or his charges dismissed on that one. And maybe the undercover FBI informant that entrapped his kid wasn't really a CIA agent, but an undercover FBI informant. Or maybe it was an actual ISIS guy. I don't know. But it sounded to me like it was probably the CIA recruited him. Hey, you want to go to Syria to fight, huh? Here you go. Or at least that sounds like what the FBI might have told him. How are we going to get this guy to join up with terrorists? I know, point out that America is on the side of the terrorists in this one, and it's perfectly fine. And then it'll be perfectly fine. I don't know. If you were an FBI informant, isn't that what you would have done? Hey, just check the front page of the New York Times. The CIA is backing the jihadists against Assad. See? So it's okay for you to go. There's no secret about this covert foreign policy. Everyone on Earth, all 7 billion of us know. The CIA, the America, Obama, the Saudi kings, the Qatari emirs, and the bin Ladenite jihadist suicide bomber terrorists have been working with the Turks and the Israelis to overthrow Assad since 2011. Everyone knows that. The hard part now is the government and the media trying to explain why the Russians are the bad guys for attacking the same guys we say we're attacking. Or having to explain why they don't seem to remember that Al-Qaeda in Syria actually exists at all. There's only the Islamic State or the opposition to Assad. Yeah, Russia, they're not even attacking the Islamic State. Instead, they're attacking the opposition to Assad. They would have you believe that the Islamic State is a pro-government militia in that war. But that wouldn't make sense. Then how come the Russians who are backing Assad are bombing them? They're not the ones with the split personality foreign policy. It's the USA. We create the Islamic State, then we cry about it. Use that as an excuse to escalate. And now, risking war with the Russians. And probably not. I'm not trying to be too damned alarmist about it, but two Russian pilots are dead today. How do you think that's playing out on the Russian street? Oh no, Russians, they're inside. It's only dirty Arabs who are always outside on the street. What do you think the Russians are saying over their kitchen tables tonight? They're white people, so they have kitchen tables instead of the street. What do you think about the Russian kitchen tables tonight at dinner? Do you think that they're saying, yeah, well, who cares if a couple of our bravest fighter aces died today at the hands of the Turks? Back to our borscht. Is that what you think they're thinking? I'm worried that this ain't over yet. I think it could be smoothed over very easily. But I'm not betting it will be. I don't know. Eric Margolies is going to be on next, and then I'm betting that he's going to say smart stuff. So we can all listen to him talk instead of me for a minute.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Well, I got Eric Margolies back on the line because, you know, big important stuff is happening over there, and who better to talk about what the hell's going on and what it all means to us than him. Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott. I'm watching these scary events in Syria and keeping my fingers crossed we're not heading into a shooting war.
Yeah, well, okay, so the news is that, for anybody who's just catching up, the news is that the Turks, a Turkish F-16 shot down a Russian, I don't know what kind of fighter bomber jet, killed two pilots, or the two pilots were killed apparently as they were parachuting down by the local FSA, CIA-backed terrorist militia there in Syria. The Turks and the Russians, of course, differ over about what side of the line they were on and whose airspace they were flying and how many warnings they got and this kind of thing. And now, I guess maybe the first question should be, why do you think that they did this? You know, Putin said, come on, man, regardless of where the line is, it's still obvious, you know, it's still clear to everyone that we bear no ill intention to the Turks. Our jet would, they couldn't even have believed that the Russian jet was targeting Turkey. Even if they were over the line, it was an accident. It wasn't even a provocation. I don't know who this serves, but it sure as hell isn't us. And so the Turks must be reading whatever Russian plane air behavior in that same way, because clearly the Russians aren't trying to pick an air war with the Turks right now. So why in the world do you think they did it? Or, you know, was it a political decision, or it was made much lower down on the chain, you suspect, or what?
No doubt, Scott, the Turks were trigger happy. They're hot-blooded people, and I think they shot down a Russian plane, or at least a drone, a couple of years ago. You're quite right. There was no need to do this. There was unnecessary. These fighter planes are traveling very fast, and they skirting the border for operations there. And intrusion is easily understandable. The Turks should have, you know, done the usual and warned them off and wiggled their wings and things like that instead of firing anti-aircraft missiles at them. It may have been a lower down decision, but I think that the head of Turkey, President Erdogan, had given orders previously to defend the border and to punish any intruders, however insignificant they are.
Hmm. You think maybe it's the fact that the Russians were bombing a bunch of terrorists and the Turks were protecting the terrorists, because that's their role in this war?
Well, you're quite right. There are, you know, very close links between these anti-Assad groups in Syria who were being armed through connivance of the United States, France, and the Turks. I mean, their arms and munitions are coming right across that border there. That's probably a primary entry point where this incident happened. It's the part of Turkey, used to be known as Alexandretta, that the Turks hold, but that is claimed by Syria, claimed the French gave it away wrongly to the Turks. So it's a very sensitive area.
Hmm. All right. So now, as far as NATO and all that, another thing Putin said was, I can't believe this. Then they call a meeting in NATO as though we had attacked them, when they're the ones who shot down our plane. And but, you know, there was a State Department flunky who put out a story, put out a statement, something along the lines of, yeah, well, you know, this is a matter for between the Turkish government and the Russian one or something, which seemed, in other words, seemed to be backing NATO right out of the argument and saying, hey, you guys work this out. We're not going to let this escalate to a NATO-level problem. But, you know, I wonder whether how certain you think that is.
Well, let's hope that's the case, Scott, because, you know, first of all, Ukraine, which brought Russia and the intrusive NATO forces or countries into almost an armed confrontation. And now this mess in Syria, it's very frightening. We're using up our nine lives far too quickly. This should not be a NATO concern. Russia is not attacking Turkey. It's not invading Turkey. But the problem is that when NATO gets involved, where NATO is really the U.S., which pulls all the strings in NATO, mm-hmm. it's very possible that you could be another great power confrontation.
Incredible. All right, now, as far as, well, and I, you know, we talked about this a bit yesterday, too. It's been a very split policy in Syria, of course, claiming to be against the terrorists while backing them against Assad all this time, and as we talked about yesterday on the show, that goes for the French, too, and for the last 4.5 years straight. While at the same time, they say, oh, no, boo-hoo, the Islamic State, they're the more obvious threat in terms of, you know, international threat. Assad never threatened the West in any way. They claim that that's just a responsibility to protect mission there, but they claim to be defending Western civilization from attack when it comes to the Islamic State, which at least, you know, may have been behind the attack in Paris, cut some Americans' throats who were actually on their territory, though. I don't know. Anyway, they can't seem to really decide what their policy is, or they seem to pursue both in a very half-assed way. And even when they say, nah, that's it, we're going to have to get over the get rid of Assad thing prioritize getting rid of the Islamic State first, they always take two steps back and turn right around and do something to, you know, solidify the older position against Assad, and that, you know, regime change is still priority one there. So I guess I just wonder what you suspect is going to come of this, or maybe which argument inside the government do you think is winning out now about what to do?
We have seen what appears to be a slight shift in thinking in Washington that, well, maybe Assad isn't such a bad guy, or we can put up with him a little longer, the old butcher of Damascus, while we address more urgent things like ISIS. I think there's a collective understanding growing in Washington that they made a really stupid mistake, and the Obama administration's and its female warrior advisors, who I keep mentioning, Susan Powers at the UN, and
I thought you were going to say Lindsey Graham.
Touche. He's the third horse person of the apocalypse. Are making military strategy, and they shouldn't be. They don't know anything about it. But Obama wants to be he's caught in the middle. He doesn't know what to do. And he doesn't want to tarnish his legacy by starting a bigger war. But sure enough, other outside forces are sucking the U.S. and its allies into a war. I'm aware where the Israelis are getting more deeply involved. The British sound now they're going to get more involved. It's a hue and a cry, but it's not thought out. The first thing we should have done, pick up a telephone, called Ankara, Turkey, get Erdogan on the phone and says, get your troops the hell out of border, your air force. Don't irritate the Russians anymore, because that could be the spark that sets off a major war.
Yeah. Well, now, so, and this goes to something that Gareth was saying on the show yesterday, which was that it's still a mystery to him why Obama is so loyal to the Saudi cause, even when in a situation like in Yemen or like in Syria, maybe if you were a stupid idiot, you might have gone along with them for a little while. But, geez, it's getting near the end of 2015 now. And Gareth was saying it's still a mystery to him how the Saudis have so much sway. I mean, it's not like we're going to stop being their allies, but let them dictate our Syria policy to this degree when it's so counterproductive to American interests. But anyway, I'm going to ask you what you think the answer to that is when we get back from this break. It's the heroic Eric Margolies, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Once again, talking Syria with the great Eric Margolies. He's the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Find his website at ericmargolies.com. Spell it like Margolis. And also he writes for lewrockwell.com and unz.com, unz.com. Now, yeah, at the break there, I was wondering out loud Gareth's question from yesterday, sort of a rhetorical one, a puzzle he's determined to solve. Why is America so damn deep in bed with the Saudis? This is beyond parody of ridiculousness now, where they're allowed to get away with, where America is willing to aid and abet what they're doing when it is obviously so contrary to American interests. I mean, even when they thought it was for their interests, yeah, let's take Iran down a peg or whatever. Now we're at the point where it's already blown back up in our face, and yet America persists. Why do you think that is?
I see a couple of reasons, Scott. First of all, the Saudis have invested, I don't know, way over $100 billion in the United States. They own all kinds of things. Not only that, they own congressmen and senators. They've taken a leaf from the book of the Israel lobby and used money to advance their political agenda. And the Saudis are very big in industrial investment in the United States, particularly in the arms industry. And they're in cahoots with all these southern senators and congressmen. So the Saudis have been very clever at playing that card in the United States. Secondly, Saudi Arabia is a key element in U.S. control of the Middle East. American air bases there, Saudi money, it is the primary reactionary force. And look how it bailed out Field Marshal al-Sisi in Egypt, a little tin pot dictator, and kept him in power by lending him, I think it was $100 million or something like that. A billion dollars, or a couple billion even. So the Saudis are very influential that way. Also, the Americans believe they need them in the Middle East. I mean, that is, it's a power base for the U.S. there. And finally, the Saudis are in line with thinking of conservative factions in the U.S. and with pro-Israel factions. They have a tacit alliance. They want the same thing. So the Saudis do have great influence, no matter how ugly they appear, cutting off people's heads, crucifying people, and things like that. As the old saying goes, they're our SOB.
Well, and I guess that's the whole thing is, you know, these terrorists who have been attacking us have been doing so because we are allies of their despotisms. So they're all from our friendly states. So we're going to just keep being, you know, allies with our enemies. If anything, Iraq War II is the aberration where they tripped and fell and stupidly fought a war for Iran for a minute before switching back to Saudi again.
Well, that's right. The stupidity of the Bush administration is still only now being fully discovered. What disasters they created and how many stupid or illegal things that they did. Remember, most of the hijackers in the 9/11 hijackers were Saudis, and they were fighting against, they were one of the things they, two of their points in staging these murderous attacks was, number one, to free Saudi Arabia from American occupation. Secondly, to take a position on Palestine, to punish Israel for that. But you know, final point on this, the Saudis are supporting all of America's allies in the Middle East financially. Mm. And control of Saudi oil is one of the pillars of American world domination. He who controls the country that controls the oil is the big power. And the U.S. still dominates the economies of Europe and Japan and parts of Asia because of its control of Saudi oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so the story goes, I guess, that after America's, at Israel's behest, partially, and Iranian behest as well, invaded Iraq and empowered Iran, that drove the Israelis and the Saudis closer together. And you mentioned the Saudi lobby here in the United States and how they kind of emulated the Israeli lobby. I wonder how closely they work together now that their governments are such tight allies. I wonder about how well the Saudi lobby... Is it just AKA Houston, or does it have another name? The Saudi lobby and the Israeli lobby, they really kind of work together in as an alliance in D.C. as well?
Well, it's been open knowledge for a long time that foreign nations wanting to exert some influence in Washington or get favors from the U.S. would go through the Israel lobby. The Israel lobby has become... very cleverly, the gatekeeper for foreign affairs issues. And if you get on the wrong side of the Israelis, forget about getting anything done in Washington. On the other hand, many countries use the Israelis almost as their unofficial lobbies. There are the Saudis, Singaporeans, for example, but the Saudis in particular, they have been running on the same parallel with Israel, let's say, similar thinking. Forever. The Saudis used to fulminate against Israel, but that was simply for show and for the Arab street, mm-hmm. as it was called. In the last few years, yes, they've thrown or cast aside this charade of being enemies and are cooperating very closely. There are all kinds of secret business deals between the Saudis and the Israelis. And I think you'll see more of them in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't know if you saw this, but Sherry Markson, a journalist from News Corp, was covering Israeli treatment of Mujahideen in their hospitals for the Australian. And then apparently she's a very naive reporter who's, well, what's the big deal? But they got really upset at her because she was writing down all these details. And I think they stole her notes. Took her notes away from her, whatever, and censored her. And then, but so the point being, she didn't even really get it, I guess. I was just talking with these rebels who were at war with Assad and Daesh. Yeah, she means Al-Qaeda. They were from the al-Nusra Front. Israel is still providing medical care to the al-Nusra Front, even after they promised to stop when the local Israeli Druze ambushed and shot up that ambulance full of Mujahideen in response to al-Nusra massacring a bunch of Druze for refusing to convert a couple of weeks before in Syria. And yet they persist. And I don't even understand why they do this. I mean, there's enough Mujahideen there. Is it worth the PR hit for the Israelis to keep getting caught red-handed, giving medical care to al-Qaeda, Eric?
Well, apparently so. There's a lot of footsie being played between Israel and ISIS and some of these other rebel groups. It just doesn't make it in our media because it's often blanked out. But the friend of my friend, the friend of my enemy is my friend. You know, that old story. The Israelis are active not only in medical care, but they're supplying arms. They are supplying aerial recon. They constantly overfly Syria, and they are providing intelligence. Israel has a very clear policy. In fact, just this week, the Israelis asked President Obama to recognize the Israeli annexation of Syria's Golan Heights, which were grabbed by Israel in the 1967 war, and never returned. Very strategic territory for Israel. It has water, it has high ground overlooking Galilee, and now the Israelis think they may have some oil there too. Clearly, the Israeli strategy is to destabilize Syria as much as possible, and the more that happens, the stronger its hold on the Golan Heights. In fact, I've not heard the Syrian government issue a peep about that in years. And this is like a foreign country coming in and seizing a large hunk of New Jersey.
So in other words, everything on the Golan Heights was already completely in Israel's favor, but they decided to push it. And they're willing to support the Al-Qaeda guys against Assad just so they could consolidate their hold on territory they already have.
That's right. And a weakened Syria. You know, Syria was the principal Arab state that was confronting Israel militarily, even though its forces were totally obsolete. Syria was still, you know, at forefront of the resistance to Israel. And now Syria has been largely destroyed. It's unlikely it'll ever be able to rebuild its military to any significant factor that could oppose the Israelis. So Israel got the U.S. to destroy Iraq. It has seen Syria destroyed. Egypt has been bought out of confrontation long ago under Sadat and now under al-Sisi. So there's no Arab state that's really opposing Israel anymore. And it has won a major strategic victory.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. They're so, you know, perfectly happy to brag about it in the New York Times. And they even, I think it was Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador's quoted saying, yeah, this is a nice salve for our feelings after the Iran deal. Are you kidding me? Hey, these people hear themselves talk. I think it was Dan Sanchez says, have you ever heard of such a diva empire before? You know, this aggressive warfare state that does nothing but, oh, they call it crying and shooting all day long, you know? Poor us. First, we were afraid of a safeguarded civilian nuclear program, and then America made a deal so that now it's a double extra super safeguarded beyond all reason or historical precedent civilian nuclear program. And so, in order to make us feel better, we're going to go ahead and steal some more Syrian territory. As long as we got you back in Al-Qaeda for us to keep Assad and his military on the ropes and out of our way. It's just incredible. I don't know.
Well, the next act, Scott, is going to be Israel. One of these days is going to invade Lebanon again and try and crush Hezbollah, the Shia Muslim resistance group there, and wipe it out and grab perhaps a bit of northern Lebanon, which has important water sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and when they do that, that's when they're going to regret giving Hezbollah so many years' worth of battle experience fighting for Assad against the Mujahideen in Syria. Because, you know, if they thought they had a hard time with Hezbollah in 2006, how about after they come home from this thing?
Good point. But the Israeli defense forces are very tough, and I eventually they will beat any foe that they come up against.
Do you think that they just withdrew for choice, but not because they had to in 06?
From Lebanon?
Yeah.
They did it because first they weren't winning the war. It was a stalemate, and they were losing steady casualties, and there was a great uproar inside Israel. People thought the war was stupid and unnecessary, and they were fed up. But as we're seeing with this parachuting thing, all it takes is a couple of bloody incidents to make everybody start jumping up and down and yelling for war.
Yeah. All right, well, listen, I've already kept you over. I'll let you go, but I sure appreciate it when you come on my show, Eric.
My pleasure, Scott.
Thanks again. That is the great Eric Margolies, y'all. He wrote War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Find him at UNS.com, UNC, UNS.com. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security: The Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional.
Here, the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Oh, man, you know what? I just thought of something I should have brought up with Eric there. And that was about the French urging basically an end to all the conflict between America and Russia over Syria, that we should all be allies against the Islamic State here. And, you know, the French's perspective on this, them and the Germans too, is they're basically looking for an opportunity to ratchet down tensions after the coup in Ukraine and the aftermath of the coup in Ukraine. And so the thing of it is that I don't know what they're going to do. Don't they have an Israel lobby in France? How are they getting away with saying that? You know what it is? I think that they actually lived through World War II. American fighting men. Millions and millions of them did. But the American homeland, now that we're the Nazis, the American homeland didn't have to suffer that war. But everything between Spain and Alaska did. And I think, you know, basically the French and the Germans have decided, they've seen how these things can happen. World War I started over stupidity. World War I started over a bunch of stupid posturing. Nobody wanted the war that ended up happening. But once everybody starts beating their chest, all of a sudden, tens of millions of people gotta die. And so the Germans and the French are going, hey, look, an opportunity to ally with the Russians. Now, I am absolutely not for that. I am absolutely for completely withdrawing from the Middle East entirely. And if the Russians have a war there, I think it probably won't work too well. And it'll probably kill a lot of innocent people, but we don't have to make it our problem. And we sure as hell don't have to get into fights with them over who gets to bomb the same damn targets. And I don't know, man. I just can't think of anything else to say. It's the same damn thing over and over again. Our government is on the side of the Al-Qaeda terrorists. That's why all this splitting hairs over which terrorists are being bombed by the Russians. Are they ISIS, or are they Nusra, or are they the cannibals of the Al-Farouk Brigade, or the Sotloff kidnapper sellers of the Northern Storm, or the force converters, crucifiers, head lopper offers of Arar al-Sham. And anyway, you know, I read Phil Giraldi's article today at uns.com, and I totally sympathize with this position in a lot of ways. And he concedes a lot to the anti-war side. I mean, hell, everything we know, or not everything, much of what we know about how America created this mess, we learned from Phil Giraldi, for Christ's sake. He knows how this happened. He knows this is all America's fault. He's the one who revealed that Obama had signed a finding in 2011 authorizing this covert action to take place, for Christ's sake. So, And in the article, he concedes every point to us, to the anti-war factions, that, you know, certainly we don't want an American invasion here. And certainly, yes, this is all Bush and Obama's fault, and that's a big part of it. And yes, they have all these split motivations because they're still going after Assad and they want to, you know, quarrel with the Russians and all of these things. But on the other hand, he says, these ISIS guys are really bad. I mean, he didn't say it like this, but you could say they are what George Bush pretended Saddam was. An international terrorist threat with an actual state as a home base. Not bin Laden and his few dozen friends as the guests of the Taliban. But a-hole up there calling himself Caliph Ibrahim. With four major cities under his control. And a proven and avowed willingness to target Westerners in Western countries. And as Giraldi goes down the list, he talks about how easy it is for these guys to get through and to hit soft targets. To get their hands on guns and to use them on people. And they're such sons of bitches. And they really are. He's going back to, you know, like Patrick Coburn said a year and a half ago. These guys, before even the fall of Mosul, these guys really are a lot like the Khmer Rouge, man. They are perfectly happy to butcher civilians, to enslave little girls and throw homos off the roof and whatever. Just insanity. They're completely, well, there's a statist rhyme and a statist reason to it all, but they are damn savages, the Islamic State. There's no quarrel there. Patrick Coburn says to them, the only good Shiite is a dead Shiite. And so, you know, the argument Giraldi's making is that these guys, he's a committed non-interventionist. And he's been helping warn that American foreign policy could create this mess. In fact, you guys might remember in the fall of 2014 that I was having every expert I could on the show because how paranoid I was about the Islamic State, and Phil was playing down. This is before the fall of Mosul. Phil was less concerned than Patrick Coburn or some of the others. You know, he'd been saying, look at the State Department report. There's still less than a few thousand real terrorists in the world. You know, every year he'd been saying that for a decade. But then it became the case that, no, Obama has succeeded in carrying out Osama bin Laden's wildest dreams. And it is what it is. And then, but the problem is there's no good solution. And he says, you know, America should make it somehow that the neighbors, the ones who really have something at stake, that they have to solve it. But I don't know how that is. And I don't think that the different sides are going to work together. And I don't think America can make them work together. When the different sides are the Kurds and the Turks, right there we got a problem, a major problem. And the Shia, and the Saudis and Jordanians, while the Shia are backed by the Iranians. We're going to have a meeting of the minds between Riyadh and the Badr Brigade in Iraq. Just, it can't happen, ain't going to happen. Not in that sense. My thing is this. I think if America just bugs the hell out of there, that they're contained. I think they'll make themselves a real problem for the Turks real quick. It's on the Turks to change their policy toward the Islamic State, as far as that goes. But without America having their back on all of this, I think they, you know, would be much more likely to think twice about what they're doing. But otherwise, if you look at the map, they're completely surrounded by enemies. If you look at the Islamic State, that's Western Iraq and Eastern Syria, what used to be. Maybe will one day be again, possibly. But if you go around the Islamic State in the north, they're hemmed in by, well, in northern Iraq, they're hemmed in by the Kurds. Then they're hemmed in by Turkey. who, you know, it's a semi-permeable membrane there, that border. The Turks can keep them out if they want to, for sure. Then you have Assad and Hezbollah and the Ba'athist state of Syria, the Jordanians, the Saudis, and the Shiite Iraqis. That's going around the map counterclockwise there, right? And so there you go. They're completely landlocked. The only money they make is selling oil to the Turks, which now finally the Americans and the Russians are halting with explosives, but don't need Americans to do that, to bomb gas trucks, right? And let them go out of business themselves.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah, man, I meant to get Alex Nowriste. Oh, boy, did I say his name wrong when he was on the show. Nowriste. Something like that. He wrote this thing for Cato. Syrian refugees don't pose a serious security threat. And like he always does, he goes through the numbers and shows his work. All your prejudices aside, check out the actual reality. Okay, thanks. Reality is important for people who care about, you know, reality. Hey, did you read Dan Sanchez today? They sow the cyclone, we reap the blowback. That's a great one. And he brings up my coining of the phrase, backdraft. Backdraft is like blowback, only instead of being the long-term consequences of covert foreign policies, it's the short-term consequences of overt foreign policies, however pretendedly covert they might be. Like, say, for example, bombing Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula from a living room full of guys into a full-fledged movement at war. That we are now flying as their air force for them against their enemies, the Houthis, by the way. Backdraft. Or, say, killing the Islamic Courts Union in Somalia and ending up with Al-Shabaab instead. Backdraft. You have a bad situation, lots of heat, lots of fuel for the fire. And then the Americans are the stupid idiots that kick the door down and lead to the gigantic explosion. Get it? Backdraft. Or say, backing Al-Qaeda in Libya in their war against Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. And then having those Al-Qaeda guys kill your ambassador and his staff. Backdraft. See? It exploded right in his face. Oh, literally. Look at him. He's got a... He looks like a Daffy Duck bomb blew up in his face. Backdraft. What was he doing there? He was running guns for Al-Qaeda terrorists so that they could murder Christians and Shia and Druze and Alawis in the war in Syria. You know, Syria, where America supported the terrorists against the secular government. And all those ethnic and religious minorities I just mentioned. And ended up creating the Islamic State. Not just an Islamic State, but the Islamic Caliphate for the 21st century. Backdraft. I know what we'll do. We'll hire a bunch of Nazis to overthrow the government in Kiev. And then, you know what I bet will happen? The Russians will just sit there and take it. Except that, nope, they took Crimea. And they backed the secessionists in the East who refused to recognize the rule of the new Nazi-enforced junta. And so caused a war that killed thousands of people and destabilized the entire Middle East and put a gigantic kibosh on the relationship between the United States and Russia, which has helped lead us to the current crisis that we're fighting with, you know, risking nuclear war here, messing around between NATO and Russia today. It's all just a bunch of really bad screwing around. And really, I guess I skipped ahead past the most obvious example of all is the invasion of Iraq and the decision to stay in Iraq and take the side of the Shiite supermajority against the minority, which just expanded the power of Iran and led to the rise of Al-Qaeda in Iraq to oppose them. And then, of course, the rise of Iran in Iraq and their power is what led to, as we always say, the redirection where they decided to turn back toward the terrorists that knocked the towers down. Again, Al-Nusra Front, you know, the moderates in Syria, they're still loyal, declared sworn loyal foot soldiers of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. Don't let them help you forget that. But anyway, so Dan Sanchez's article is about the Mujahideen from the Afghan War and how they came home and became a problem and how then the same thing for Iraq and then now for the Syria war too. All the consequences. Our government does all these things and we're the ones who reap the whirlwind. And I really like the whole thing about how he starts out with Rambo 3. Have you seen Rambo 3? It's the one in Afghanistan where Troutman, the, I guess the sergeant or the colonel, yeah, Colonel Troutman, who is always recruiting Rambo, he's been taken captive by the KGB. And then while they're holding him, this is what he tells his KGB interrogator.
You started this damn war. Now you have to deal with it.
And we will. It is just a matter of time before we achieve a complete victory.
You know there won't be a victory. Every day your war machines lose ground to a bunch of poorly armed, poorly equipped freedom fighters. The fact is that you underestimated your competition. If you'd studied your history, you'd know that these people have never given up to anyone. They'd rather die than be slaves to an invading army. You can't defeat a people like that. We tried. We already had our Vietnam. Now you're going to have yours.
So that's how common that was, the idea that America was helping to give the Russians their own Vietnam. Payback. Vietnam shorthand for a massive, hugely expensive, damn near genocidal, no-win catastrophe of a war that destabilizes a region, knocks dominoes over, doesn't prop them up, knocks them over, see Cambodia, Pol Pot, and the Khmer Rouge. And destabilizes and divides the society back home, too. Makes everybody hate each other that much more as they stake out their different sides on issues of such great importance. Massive, horrible, stupid, no-win quagmire. The kind of thing you'd want to trick your enemy into doing to himself. Oh, where's America right now? Oh, occupying Afghanistan for the last 15 years straight. and bombing all the rest of the Middle East. As though they all secretly work for bin Laden's rotting corpse, and their only job in the world is proving him right about everything. And if you listen to the real hawks, they say what we really got to do is get rid of the theocracy in Iran. You know, that way to pave the way for a Sunni caliphate all the way from between, you know, India and the Jordan River. Right? The Israeli Likudnik fifth columnists in America cry, we've got to get rid of Shiite-dominated Iran. It's blocking the contiguous territory of the Islamo-fascist caliphate we're creating. Damn geography. Somebody overthrow those Persians for us, they cry. Well, just wait till Jeb comes.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Superior blends of premium coffee, roasted fresh in Zionsville, Indiana. Darren's Coffee satisfies the casual and the connoisseur. Scott Horton Show listeners, visit darrenscoffee.com and use the coupon code SCOTT at checkout for free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. So, listen, I forgot if I mentioned this on the show or not, but I did this conference, the Texas Millennial Institute, up there in Fort Worth a little while back, and got to meet a lot of great fans of the show, had come out to see me and that kind of thing, man, so it was really cool. Got to meet Brad Hoff from the Levant Report there and quite a few others. And one guy was, I forget now if he was Army or Air Force. I forget. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And he said that he heard my interview of Justin Pavone, the conscientious objector. The government employee turned libertarian, turned conscientious objector. And he heard that show, and that day he filed for his CO status. That day he moved to get out of the military. And I thought, hey, that's nice to hear. I mean, I don't know who the hell's listening to this or what difference it makes to anybody or whatever. I know I got Fitzy G and JDA in the chat room for me every day. I know they're hearing me. But I don't really know who's playing MP3s of what for who. You know, there's a million of them. 4,000. And anyway, so that's one thing that happened when one guy heard one interview. And I thought that was cool. And then Eric Garris just sent me this. It's Ron Paul interviewing Justin Pavone. From today. I love Ron Paul.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
Happy Monday, sir.
Well, very good. We have a special guest and a friend on our program today, Justin Pavone, who is a former Air Force flight pilot who has seen active duty. And, Justin, I want to welcome you to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Dr. Paul. Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Well, very good. Thank you. First off, I wanted to thank you and your wife, Jessica, not only for your, you know, everybody gets thanks for their service, including myself when I've been in the military. Thank you for your service, which sometimes is offensive, but we want to thank you for your service to promote the cause of liberty. And we also want to thank both of you for being strong supporters for the Institute of Peace and Prosperity, of course, the organization that Daniel is the executive director, so support like that to us is very important. But before we get into the question about a recent article you wrote, I wanted to ask you a little bit, because you ally yourself with we who call ourselves libertarians, and quite frankly, I don't know understand exactly when you became a libertarian, or you used that term, was it your experience in the military specifically, or was it something that you had heard about when you were in the military, before you went to the military? How did that come about?
Right. So my wife actually wrote an article about this called Ron Paul, the Gateway Drug. And for us in particular, it was foreign policy, but we were in Afghanistan and we were listening to you on the 2012 debates. And pretty much everything you were saying with regards to the wars was really ringing true with our experience over there. And, you know, that was the initial subject, you know, foreign policy and the issue of peace versus war and self-defense versus aggression that really got us to go down the rabbit hole. I was already sort of a free enterprise supporter, but the whole ideology of libertarianism as a whole kind of came together once we heard you in those debates and then started doing some research on our own.
Well, a lot of people have thought along your terms of what you've gone through, but Daniel has a question more specifically on something that you've done recently for the Institute.
Yeah, Justin, you wrote a really interesting article a few days ago, and it was originally on antiwar.com, but we picked it up at the Ron Paul Institute as well, and it was about conscientious objection, and it almost is kind of a quaint term, or brings back the 60s, and I think a lot of people don't talk about it, but you bring it up in a whole new light, and you talk about some of the trials and tribulations that you had trying to get out of the military as a conscientious objector. Could you give us a little background there and what it means, and also what it means today especially?
Sure. So conscientious objection was a lot more well-known and popular in the 70s or late 60s when the Vietnam War was going on and the U.S. was using a draft to provide personnel for the military. Obviously, when you're being coerced into the military, it creates a lot more resistance out of the population. So one of the avenues for people to get out of military service that didn't want to fight in a war was conscientious objection, and that's basically a moral opposition to all war. People today in the voluntary military think that conscientious objection isn't really applicable anymore. That's not the case. When you go into the military, you sign a piece of paper that basically says you're not a conscientious objector. But, you know, for people like myself, you know, I had a life experience where I changed my opinion about my moral beliefs and what we were doing while I was in the military. And so there is an avenue to get out of the military as a conscientious objector, assuming that your beliefs changed while you were actually in the service. So it's still a very relevant issue, more so for people that are actually in the military themselves rather than for people that aren't forced to become a part of the military just as normal civilians.
We made a great point in the article that I, to be honest, hadn't really thought that much of, and it is the difference between a conscientious objection and what you like to point out is much preferable, the idea of a selective objection. Could you fill us in on the difference between those two?
Right. So selective objection is basically the opposition to this war. Like, I think the Iraq war is wrong, or I think that the Syrian war is wrong. Conscientious objection is more of a philosophical opposition to all war at all times, no matter what. And a lot of people have a little bit of an aversion to the idea of being against all wars at all times because most of us recognize the inherent right of people to defend themselves. And so, you know, they think that because you would conscientiously object to all wars, you don't think that it's okay to defend themselves, and it's sort of doesn't make logical sense with a lot of people. That's why selective objection, I think, is so important, because most people sort of think of the theoretical possibility of a just war happening as a reason to dismiss conscientious objection, but they might be opposed to any one particular war as like an aggressive war or an immoral war. And I think it's really important to give people the freedom of conscience to act in the particular situation that they're faced with, you know, on their conscience. If you think the Vietnam War is wrong, you shouldn't have to participate. You certainly don't want to be coerced into, you know, violence against your fellow man if you have nothing against them. It's not a good thing for society. And the same goes with, you know, the wars of today.
You know, Justin, on the Internet, and I think it occurred after we talked before, there was some serious thought-out criticisms of our position, and especially yours, and they were saying, well, Justin, you signed up, you signed your contract, and now you want to separate yourself from this contract. Do you had that directed at you where you've actually given an answer to that? Do you want to comment on that that challenge?
Yeah, sure. So I definitely have gotten a lot of criticism about that. I have two things to say about it. Number one, I don't think it's whatsoever opting out of your contract. It's a totally legal loophole in the contract that says if you think that this war is immoral, you don't have to participate. You can, you know, as part of a normal administrative application, apply for conscientious objection if you get accepted. they can let you out scot-free. It's just part of the rules of the military. So there's nothing below board whatsoever with the process. You know, the other thing I think on a larger picture, though, is, you know, even if that weren't the case, you know, I think both parties are subject to the contract. So the government can be defunct in its obligation to the soldier just as much as the soldier can be defunct in its obligation to the government. And I think soldiers have an obligation to interpret not only the legality and the constitutionality of wars, but also, more importantly, the morality of a war, and to stand for all of the above, but most importantly, the moral principles, you know, of self-defense and non-aggression above and beyond whatever else may, you know, may be considered.
All right, let's stop it right there. I want to play the rest of this. Don't you guys want to hear it? It's the heroic Ron Paul interviewing the heroic Justin Pavone about conscientious objection. And, hey, maybe we'll get one more person to quit the armed forces today.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, I'm Scott Horton. Wrapping up for the day here. I'm so sick and tired of it. Just go to look at antiwar.com for the news on Syria. But I want to continue on with this great interview. It's Ron Paul and Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And they're interviewing Justin Pavone about getting the hell out of the military. And it's great.
I think this is important, and you touched on the point that I think is a powerful point. Matter of fact, the first point that you are following a legal procedure is something that I wasn't aware of before, and I think that's very important for a lot of people. But the other thing is once you're in the military, there could be easy assumption, especially if you're 18 or 19-year-old where so many people join, that our government will do the right thing and they're going to obey the laws and not do anything illegal or unconstitutional. Once you get involved, the war may morph into something else. It may be that they start off in a real restrained manner. You join the military to defend the country, and all of a sudden you find out that the army that you joined or the Air Force you've joined has all of a sudden morphed into something that is totally unconstitutional. I would think it would be easy for us to charge the government with breaking a contract, if anybody.
Right, so I totally agree with everything you just said, and in fact, that mirrored my own personal experience a lot. You know, I joined after 9/11 thinking that our country got attacked, that I wanted to legitimately defend our country from people who were aggressively acting against it. You know, as it turns out, what we're essentially doing overseas is assassinating a bunch of so-called terrorists without trial, without charge, in any country of our choosing. Basically with no rule of law, with no transparency, no declaration, and no constrained categorization of who, in fact, could be or is a terrorist, whether it's an American citizen or a foreigner, this country or that country. And it's morphed into something that is essentially a recipe for breeding terrorism rather than a mechanism to defend against the very thing that got us started in it.
Now, Justin, you mentioned in your article that in your experience there are a great many very thoughtful people in the military who entertain some of the doubts that you have about American foreign policy and the direction. They're sitting there, they're thinking these thoughts that you had thought at one point. What would you say to them right now, given your experience in getting out, if they're having the same thoughts as you were?
Well, I think like you guys mentioned, you know, a lot of people have stereotypes about their commitment, and a lot of people, myself included, want to, you know, do what they've said they're going to do. And that's a big barrier to leaving the military. You know, people feel very trapped by their so-called contractual obligation. And I think dispelling the, you know, wrong assumptions about that are important, for one. I just lost my train of thought there a little bit, guys, but do you mind getting me back?
Yeah, what would you say to someone who might be watching the show who's having the same thoughts that you had?
Yeah, you know, I think people need encouragement. If you feel like what is happening overseas is wrong, if it's morally wrong, I think you have an obligation to, first of all, even if it's legal, disregard the legality. I think that the wars are blatantly illegal. You don't have the authority in the Constitution, and international law certainly doesn't allow you to aggressively invade countries and overthrow their governments. That's not legal in any sense of the word. But even if it was, you know, you have a moral obligation to yourself and your conscience, and I think we need to encourage these people to act on their consciences. And, you know, if you're one of the minority, or perhaps, you know, a much larger minority than people think, who think the wars are wrong, I would encourage you to, you know, to leave or do what you can to not participate and opt out peacefully. There are a lot of supporting agencies out there. You know, our friend, who I hope you have on, Maria Santelli at the Center on Conscience and War, is a really great resource for GIs that are struggling with, you know, the morality of what their government is forcing them to do. And I think you can look into that and many other resources out there.
Justin, frequently when I've been on college campuses talking about foreign policy and economic policies, and a lot of young people will get excited and they say, boy, that your philosophy makes a lot of common sense. And then they'll say, what should I do? What should I do? And, you know, I sort of give a sort of a flippant answer. I said, do whatever you want to do. You know, it's like everybody has an obligation. There's no set pattern. And I would say that's exactly what you did. You did something under the circumstances that you thought was morally correct, and you felt good about your decision. And in a way, it contradicts the conclusion of a song that I use in my book, Swords into Plowshares, the Universal Soldiers, saying that it's an anti-war song, but it says that, you know, there would be no wars if we didn't have the Universal Soldier who always went to war and they never could stand up. And I sort of conclude that there is a chance that we could become the only resistance to war, because governments notoriously always start the war. So if we could attack this, and I think this is exactly what you're doing, you're saying that if you don't have the soldiers to drop the bombs and shoot the guns, of course, you would still have the wars, because, but they would only be defensive wars if you could ever get to do it. And I think this, what you're doing is fantastic. It's a personal responsibility. It's a moral judgment. It fits into our Constitution. And I just think that you're sort of dispelling this notion that forever and ever we'll have the Universal Soldier, and they've been around for thousands of years, but there's no reason why we can't challenge the status quo of anything. And I think that's what our job right now, and I think what you're doing is great.
You know, Justin, I was preparing for the show, I was thinking about a very memorable moment in the Foreign Affairs Committee when Dr. Paul was in Congress, and he was arguing against going to war with Iraq. And he said, well, why are we going to go? They don't attack us. They haven't attacked us. And you mentioned this in your article. They haven't attacked us. Why do they want us to go to war? And one member said to him, well, of course they're attacking us. They're shooting at our planes as we're bombing them. So that was the justification that they gave for the war.
Anyways, it was in that same discussion that the chairman of the board, when I insisted they vote on an up or down vote on declaration of war, which I told him I'd, of course, vote against, he said, well, that part of the Constitution is an anachronism. And I thought, oh, boy, this is what we're facing. But we don't have to face that constantly. We're going to change all that. Justin, and I want to thank you very much for once again visiting with us. I think it's very important that more people hear your story.
Well, thank you guys both very much for having me on. I appreciate it, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay. I want to thank our audience for tuning in today. This is a very important subject because it has to do with war and peace and moral responsibility of the individual. I don't believe in collectivism for rights or punishments. And actually, ideas are individual too, but ideas spread and larger numbers endorse those. So when the ideas of peace spread, we will have peace. Right now, we're facing a tremendous barrage of false stories and propaganda going on, you know, with ISIS and other things, as if the world is going to end tomorrow. And it's all based on falsehoods. So this is the goal that we have, is to get the truth out. And of course, Daniel deserves a lot of credit with the Institute of Peace and Prosperity, because that is the goal, is to figure out how we can get a larger number of people who will act morally on their by themselves to resist the temptation of accepting war. And I was part of that, because when I was a young doctor and drafted in the Vietnam area, you know, I wasn't ready to think about this or resist. I spent all my time studying medicine, and as a flight surgeon, I started to get an inkling of what was going on. But I think the whole purpose is to teach people that peace and prosperity comes from a moral principle of liberty for every individual. And though a lot of people talk about American exceptionalism, I'm not talking about that cliche that is used so carelessly. But there are some values that have been American values in the past that we need to not only restore but build on, because I think that nothing has been perfect in the past. It won't be perfect tomorrow, but there's no reason why we can't improve economic ideas as well as foreign policy idea, so that we can truly work for peace and prosperity. And I want to thank everybody today for tuning in, and please come back to the Liberty Report soon.
Man, Ron Paul is my hero. Isn't he great? What a great leader of men. He's like, hey, everyone, you know what? You could believe in freedom more than you do, and it'd be fine. Won't hurt. Hey, you can't believe in freedom too much. Freedom's what works. Freedom's what's right. And what a deep and dark shadow he casts with his light when it hits the rest of the scum who deal in power. Well, thankfully he's out of power now. Even better. All right. See y'all tomorrow. I'll be here tomorrow.